Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We'd be remiss if we didn't remark upon the passing of Ivana Trump, the ex-wife of the former president, passed away unexpectedly at 73 yesterday.
Reports are she either had a heart attack and fell down the stairs or fell down the stairs at her 64th Street apartment there in Manhattan.
Found in a wellness check.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's unfortunate. And
73 is young. You all know that. Right, Dan? You of all people?
Yeah.
73 is the new 50?
Something like that. Yeah. It's been a walk down tabloid memory lane, though. I mean,
isn't it interesting watching it all?
You forget sometimes about what you live through, but the whole the New York Post did like a compendium of their covers when they were sort of the it power couple in New York in the 80s. And then they got divorced. And
yeah, then he had his affair with Marla Maples.
And, you know, then, I mean, all you know.
You just forget about
Trump share Florida palace, but in separate beds, and how sweet it was with a picture of Marla Maples in her skivvies, and so on and so forth. It's wild. It's wild to think back in the 80s that you were looking at a future president of the United States then.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636, type in DA. Then a quick comment.
And by the way, Ivana, no shrinking violet herself.
No, she was an incredible woman. I mean, she, fled communism and then came to this country and embraced it. She loved it.
Eric Trump, one of her sons, of course, including Don Jr. and her daughter, Ivanka. But Eric Trump said in a statement, "Our mother was an incredible woman, a force in business, a world-class athlete, a radiant beauty, and a caring mother and friend. She'll be dearly missed by her mother, her three children, and her 10 grandchildren."
They
also did like a review of her most outspoken moments.
Yeah.
And one of her lines during the tumult of the 80s with the divorce and the affair and something, "Don't get mad, get everything."
Yep. Well, she was in that First Wives Club movie. She made a cameo.
Yeah, that's right.
And she said that line.
Yeah, that's right.
In that movie. But also Ivanka Trump wrote, "Heartbroken by the passing of mother. Mom was brilliant, charming, passionate, and wickedly funny. She lived life to the fullest, never foregoing an opportunity to laugh and dance. I will miss her forever and will keep her in memory and keep her memory alive in our hearts always."
You know, the other thing that was interesting about the relationship between Ivana and the Donald in the context of politics, you know, she came back into the fold, not in a significant way, but she had nothing but good things to say about Donald Trump when he was running for president, said he would make a good president. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they sort of I thought about it at the moment, and then I was reminded of it by watching the series The Offer, which I'll save it for Open Mic Friday. But I've got a review on The Offer. It's outstanding. Outstanding. One of the best limited series I've ever seen. But I was reminded of her coming back and supporting Trump, or at the time when she did that, when he was running for president. It was like Ally McGraw coming back to Bob Evans to accompany him to the premiere of The Godfather. That's how I thought about it.
That's,
you know,
a good,
I mean,
analogy.
It was, you know, they had split at the time, and yeah, she was with Steve McQueen, but she came back anyway for one last turn with Evans because it was his big night with The Godfather and so on and so forth. And so Ivana coming back when he was running for president, and rather than feeding the tabloid monsters, she just said, you know, she was classy. She had good things to say in the interests of not just, I think, her ex-husband, but also her family,
yeah,
because they were so integral to his campaign. And Jim, it's just interesting.
In 2017, she gave an interview to Jim Axelrod from CBS News, and they talk. She goes, Donald and I talk once a week, at least. And then Donald asked her.
Right. That's
and
right.
Donald
yeah.
asked her if he should stop tweeting. And then Jim Axelrod said, wait, what? And he asked you if he should stop. I said, honey, don't stop tweeting. Keep going. She reminds me a lot of Jean-Jacques Gabor. Like
there's a little bit of that, yeah.
Yeah, but she said, don't stop tweeting. Just, you know, say your piece. And he didn't stop tweeting. So, and this is Donald Trump back in the day when she was running the Plaza Hotel.
Managing one specific diamond like the Plaza Hotel, I don't think there's anybody better.
See, they were always complimentary to each other. And
yeah, and people do forget that.
They were a team.
She was part of the Trump world, the operation, the business side of the deal, as well as obviously the family.
You're working as a team, and you're working on the same thing. Donald owns it, and I own it. We own it together.
They were a team. And I feel so bad for the grandkids and for her three children because they were very close to their mother.
Yeah.
She raised them. I mean, I know Donald was in the, President Trump was in their life, but she did the heavy lifting.
Well, I mean, again, you know, we talked about this during the campaign for all of the wildness that surrounded them for so long and for Donald Trump his entire adult life. You know, the kids turned out pretty well.
Oh, they turned
out. Say what you want about Ex Machina. And that Emo Phillips character that she's married to, but Eric Trump and Don Jr. and Ivanka, they're all, you know, pretty well adjusted, pretty successful people in their own right. So that says something about mom and dad too.
It's like a hot steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer. On AM560, the...
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Answer. America First with Sebastian Gorka. Today at 3, right before Sean Thompson at 4 on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday, the pack that I operate went up with radio and TV spots on the governor's race, focusing on, well, where the focus should be, the governor and the last 4 years under one Governor Spaulding. You may have heard it on our airwaves, but this is the 60-second radio version. The 30-second TV version is similar.
It's ridiculous over here in Illinois. It really is.
How much worse does it have to get?
So expensive nowadays. I wait till the last minute, hoping that the prices will go down.
How much longer can you wait for relief? Governor Pritzker's doubling the state's gas tax gave Illinois some of the highest gas prices in the nation, yet the potholes in Chicago could swallow a CTA bus. Now Pritzker is forcing businesses to lie to their customers for his benefit.
Only thing Illinois is doing is delaying a gas tax increase and calling that a tax cut.
In Illinois, you have to sue to be able to tell the truth.
Gas station owners in Illinois are suing the state over a new law they claim violates their free speech rights.
How much longer will you be made to play the fool? In the last 4 years, Pritzker added another $2,165 to the tax burden Illinois families shoulder, which was already the highest in the nation. How much more of Pritzker can you afford? How much worse does it have to get before you make a change? Paid for by people who play by the rules pack.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. You know what I find particularly offensive, and it's mentioned in the ad, and we've talked about it, but I wonder if it's really resonating as you have gas station owners recoiling at being forced to post the governor's political propaganda. Just how fundamentally dishonest, not to mention overbearing, bordering on authoritarian, that mandate is. You have to post that they were providing temporary relief from the inflationary increase in a gas tax that I doubled. You're not compelled to mention that just 3 years ago, I doubled the gas tax, indexed it for inflation. And as you hear in the spot from a guy from the Trade Association for retail gas station owners, it's a temporary suspension of the incremental inflationary increase until January.
Like what, 2 cents maybe?
Yeah, 2 cents.
2 cents?
Two cents for five months.
But they made this gas station owners pay for the stickers themselves. They didn't provide the stickers for them, and that was part of the lawsuit. Is, hey, wait, you're making me do something, and I have to pay for it on top of it? It's ridiculous. And then if you put up a sticker that says he did this in a picture of Biden, you can get charged with a felony.
Well, right. I get the whole defacing private property, but I mean, felony, okay. But I just, in addition, it's not bad enough that you have one of the highest, the second highest gas tax in the nation in Illinois. That's not bad enough. They have to come over the top and compel people to lie about what's happening. I mean, being compelled to lie on behalf of the state under force of law. Does that strike anybody as a new development, one more step down the road to serfdom in Illinois? They're sort of tandem questions. They're sort of connected. How much worse does it have to get? How much longer will you willingly play the fool? I mean, good for the gas station owners
that fought back,
that are suing to say this is no. And the gas station owners that are putting up their own signs that add a little bit more context to the official state-sanctioned propaganda. I just think that's something that... Whether you support, whether you buy the reason for the doubling of the gas tax or not, whether you buy all the reasons for all of the tax burdens in Illinois, highest combined state and local tax burden in the nation before Pritzker took office. Now we've just built our lead over the rest of the nation. Whether you believe all that or not, you really believe that the state should compel a private business owner to rinse and repeat their political propaganda? To me, that's something new.
Yeah. Well, Pritzker, I remember we asked him about it in a press conference months ago, and he said, a Republican governor did that. And I said, which Republican governor did that? During an election year?
Republican governor did what?
Had stickers at the gas pumps. And I don't... Which Republican governor? I think he said Edgar. I'll look it up, but he just said it. He's like, well, I'm not the first to do this. Next question.
Even if that's true, which I don't think it is, I don't remember that under Edgar, but maybe I'm, maybe I forgot. Thompson. How far does he want to go back?
Kerner.
But I mean, just the idea. I'm not the first to do it. It's like Blagojevich saying, I'm not the first to commit felonies as governor, so, what's the big deal?
And listen to this.
What?
Listen to this nugget. So he's been in New Hampshire, then he was in D.C., then he was in Augusta, Maine the past 2 days promoting Illinois policies. That's what it said in the press release. We're there promoting Illinois policies and priorities.
Recruiting all those corporate titans that have their headquarters in Maine.
Guess where he's going Saturday? He's going to Florida, folks. Are you ready for this? This is his spokesperson for his campaign, Natalie Edelstein. Florida is in dire need of a pro-choice Democratic governor. And Governor Pritzker is proud to support the Florida Democratic Party in their efforts to flip the state blue. So he's going to be speaking at an event Saturday.
Well, yes.
Tickets go from $300 to $1,000 each. But, I mean, come on, stay home. And I agree with Darren Bailey. Get back here.
I've got a message for Governor Pritzker. Get back home. Let's work on surging police support in Chicago and let's slash your gas tax and stop campaigning for president.
Because that's what he's doing.
Well,
obviously,
I actually don't miss him that much. But I mean, I get the point of, in terms of where he should be. I mean, what he's really going to do about, for example, the price at the pump in Illinois. You've gotten everything he's going to do. He's going to temporarily suspend the inflationary increase and then force people to lie to you about it. All done.
Good job.
Mike in Plano, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, guys. You know, speaking of Darren Bailey, after he won the primary overwhelmingly, unfortunately, his general election campaign got off to a rough start with those comments on the 4th of July regarding the Highland Park shooting, you know, saying the words, just move on or something like that. But, and listen, I understand it was off the cuff, but of course it, you know, trended on social media and the media blew it up and into something that was totally out of proportion. And, Dan, I wanted to ask you how much you think that hurts his campaign, because I'm sure the Pritzker and the Democrats are going to do everything they can to keep drumming it up throughout the general election campaign. But with the way news cycles go today, by October, are people going to remember any of this stuff? We'll be talking about something different. So I just wanted to ask what your thoughts were on that.
Thanks for the call, Mike. I would say a couple things. One is, yeah, it will dissipate, but then you've got a guy spending $100 million or hundreds of million dollars probably before it's all said and done who will remind people of it and, of course, demagogue it. So it was an unforced error by Darren Bailey. It was something he shouldn't have said. It was an idiotic thing to say. Horrible. And in that moment, you need to be thoughtful. And he apologized for it.
His apology, though, that was genuine. I appreciated his apology.
So sometimes, you know, I mean, everybody's the thing that seems to me with politicians, we always that's so frustrating is, you know, that you non-apology apologies and they're never wrong and they never make a mistake. You're a human being. You do a stupid thing. You own it, and you do the best to offer contrition, and then you continue to make your case. That's all he can do. So it's not helpful. It wasn't helpful, that's for sure, because it was a dumb thing to say. But he took ownership of it, and that's exactly what he should have done. And then people have to make up their own minds and sort of, you know, in totality, looking at the two options in terms of the policy agendas, and frankly, and this is going to be important for Bailey, making sure the focus is where it should be, as I began this segment stating. The first thing is you make an assessment of the person in the office and what they've done while they're in the office and how things are going for you since they've been in the office. That's the first thing. Pritzker wants to make it, of course, about Bailey and demagogue him on guns and so forth, the comment that he made. And it's going to be the job of the campaign to make sure that it's an election like most elections, which are referenda on the incumbents.
I got a new thing, sticking up a lie. How do you like that?
Yeah, it's not bad.
Thank you.
Keep workshopping.
All right.
Marvin, Burlington, Wisconsin.
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all that the government in Illinois is making people, forcing them political speech that they don't want to say. I mean, they can't describe what a woman is. They think abortion on demand is okay. I mean, the list just goes on and on. And I'm surprised at the polls even is what they are. I mean, are people that brain dead and brainwashed? I mean, this is across the country. It's astonishing to me that our education system over the past 50 years has basically destroyed society's ability to think logically and reason properly. They've taken anything that looks like a cross out of the school, which basically means there's no consequences for anything. No one has in touch with their own and conscience to have an idea of what is just generally right and wrong. And no, I'm not surprised at all. And I think it's just going to continue down this path. And Governor Pritzker, I mean, going out to Maine, well, that's just a bunch of like-minded people out there. I mean, it's like Lori Lightfoot going to Europe saying that Chicago is a thriving business community as a Fortune 500 companies are leaving or looking to relocate. It's astonishing.
Thanks for the call, Marvin. Yeah, I wonder when Lori Lightfoot mandates that all Chicagoans repeat her propaganda. Chicago is a thriving city that is attracting business.
Crime is down. Crime is down.
We just plant the chips in our brains already and let's be done with it.
Listen to this. If you're non-compliant, you can get fined $500 a day.
Yeah, right. the gas stations, right, which is why they're suing.
Well, yeah, and also, too, Pritzker did say, he said, this is the same sticker that was put on the on pumps when there was a Republican governor 20 years ago.
Who was governor 20 years ago? Well, 20 years ago would have been George Ryan. Yeah, I mean, literally, he was elected in 98, out in 2002. Blagojevich comes in 2003, so I don't know what he's talking about. It's actually
like, well, your governor did it 20 years ago.
It's actually irrelevant.
It is irrelevant.
And we had this moment where we a law passed where we removed politicians' ability to put signage up everywhere with their name because we understand that's just sort of branding and it's inherently political. How about Rod Blagojevich over the tollways, right? The automatic tolling. So it's the same sort of thing here. Chris on the Dan Ryan.
Yeah, hey, Dan. I guess you answered my question a few minutes ago in regards to this lawsuit. I believe, and again, I haven't followed it, but I believe that they're still suing Pritzker. Is that correct?
Yeah, a federal judge threw out the lawsuit that was filed by the Illinois Fuel and Retail Association in a frankly a ridiculous Pollyannish opinion in which she wrote, the signage does not contain controversial statements. Plaintiffs cite no case law authority to support their contention that the signage is political. Honestly,
they're playing gas pump politics and she knows it.
Do you live on this planet? I mean, come on, especially when we're talking about Illinois. She said the signage actually furthers the defendants, meaning the governor's stated goal of ensuring the customers actually are aware of and obtain the benefit of the General Assembly suspension of the inflation adjustment to this. Did you take the 2 cents a gallon off? Come on.
And it's we're talking 2 cents.
Chris.
Can I sue the supermarkets and tell them that they need to have furry animals walking around and stocking my shelves because that's discriminatory? And I mean, where does it end? Honestly, where does it end where it's like you have to do something because I think it's better meant for the public? I mean, come on.
He's a tyrant.
Thanks for the call,
I mean,
Chris.
If people haven't you can't wake up during COVID. You're not going to wake up. Chris, but with this gas pump sticker, it's worse.
Chris and Carrie.
Hey, good morning, Dan, Amy. Amy, next time there's a press conference and Pritzker even brings up, the black and brown people, why don't you just say gas tax? Why don't you say grocery tax? You know, every policy that any administration does, and I'm just talking about the local level right now, but every policy they put forth hurts which people the most, the black and brown people, right? I mean,
disproportionately,
disproportionately, absolutely. So why don't you bring it up every time he talks about black and brown or Lori Lightfoot? Just throw out gas tax or grocery tax or some other tax.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Chris. Yeah, I think there's some movement afoot among minority communities, including in Illinois, particularly Latinos. But the sentiment of the guy who opens a commercial, who's a black gentleman, Illinois, it's ridiculous here. Yeah, that about sums it up. I mean, it really does.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630. And learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I know no one is really paying attention to the Jan 6 Commission except the D.C. press corps, so they can rinse and repeat their black helicopter theories about what happened on that day. But they're trying to get your attention. They're trying to get your attention. And if insurrection, coup d'etat, if that's not enough, they'll fast forward to present day and what might be coming, rather than looking retrospectively, prospectively at the need to take to the streets to, I don't know, according to Malcolm Nance, who's a former naval officer, and he's some sort of half-baked counterterrorism expert for MSNBC. Talk about a contradiction in terms. That's what he says. First from Malcolm Nance, the pro forma introductory statement about the violent attempt to overthrow the United States government that he alleges happened on January 6th. I mean, just so you know, since you're not paying attention, and I'm not suggesting you should, that this is just something that is rinsed and repeated every 15 minutes on the hour every day by the left and by their comm channels, through their comm channels.
Yeah, well, you know, as a terrorism expert, I usually remove phrases like Muslim or Christian or Catholic or white, but I'm talking about extremists. Most extremists have an ideology that they're following. But here in the United States, to characterize that, to understand just what kind of terrorism we might be dealing with, you have to actually label it according to what as white extremism. Because we have 30% of the population of the United States who no longer believe in the democratic norms that were established at the founding of the country. Let's just be honest about that. The January 6th uprising was an attempt to overthrow American democracy. And we've now learned from these hearings that Donald Trump intended to go there and march down to the well of the House of Representatives and essentially be crowned as a king.
Yeah, that's the kind of hysteria that you're missing. By the way, that's something, what you heard from Malcolm Nance, that's something not even John Bolton believes. John Bolton, a pretty outspoken critic of the president since he was dismissed as his national security advisor. You've heard what he's had to say about the president, and he ascribes some blame to the president for the rioting that took place on January 6th. But before we go to Nance, just John Bolton recently getting in an argument with Jake Tapper, who was doing his best Malcolm Nance impersonation over what happened on January 6th.
So important to understand, while nothing Donald Trump did after the election in connection with the lie about the election fraud, none of it is defensible. None of it is defensible. It's also a mistake, as some people have said, including on the committee, the commentators, that somehow this was a carefully planned coup d'etat aimed at the Constitution. That's not the way Donald Trump does things. It's rambling from one half-vast idea to another, one plan that falls through and another comes up. That's what he was doing. As I say, none of it defensible. But you have to understand the nature of what the problem of Donald Trump is. He's, to use a Star Wars metaphor, a disturbance in the force. And it's not an attack on our democracy. It's Donald Trump looking out for Donald Trump. It's a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence.
I don't know that I agree with you, to be fair, with all due respect. One doesn't have to be brilliant to attempt a coup.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat,
yeah,
not here, but, you know, other places, It takes a lot of work. And that's not what he did. It was just stumbling around from one idea to another. Ultimately, he did unleash the rioters at the Capitol. As to that, there's no doubt. But not to overthrow the Constitution, to buy more time to throw the matter back to the states to try and redo the issue.
So there you have a pretty strident Trump critic offering his characterization from the inside of what was actually happening. And I, by the way, do not stipulate to everything John Bolton said there, particularly about unleashing the rioters and so forth. But it doesn't matter. They persist because they have a point. The left I'm talking about. And the point is exactly what we said it would be on January 7th. All 75 million people who voted for Trump are domestic terrorists, or at least suspected mm-hmm. of being.
And if you voted for him, you did that on January 6th. You were a part of it.
You're right. You're part of propagating their so-called big lie and so on and so forth. You're not allowed to question the election. Otherwise, you're the administration of the election in any particular state. Raise any questions. Otherwise, you are a domestic terrorist. You're somebody who is borderline guilty of treason, the way they talk about it. And thus, you're going to have to be dealt with accordingly. Now, let's go back to Malcolm Nance and where he sees this going. Remember, what you're hearing from is somebody who purports to be a great guardian of our representative republic. He's going to save democracy for us, Malcolm Nance.
You know, a year and a half ago when I was calling this an insurgency, people were actually saying that's crazy. This is not an insurgency. This is not like Iraq. This is not like Libya. It's not like Syria. Well, it is. And it's well on its way. It's closer to the beginnings of the Irish Republican Army. Irish Republicanism, where now the Republican Party is Sinn Féin, and it's just a matter of seeing who comes up as the provisional Irish Republicans in this story and starts carrying out acts of violence in order to effect change. So we are well on to our way to a multi-year campaign. We're already 2 years into this campaign where we may have to fight the they in my title, and the they in my title who want to kill Americans are your neighbors.
Wow.
We may have to fight the insurgency against the they, Republicans who want to kill you. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. And then
I'm waiting for
Lori Lightfoot to lecture me again about the civility of our discourse and seeing the dignity in another in every human being and so forth. This has gone unremarked upon, more or less, but at least from what I've seen in the last 24 hours. And I know he's an unremarkable person. He's just some, hack pundit on MSNBC. He's not important. But
people are listening.
Well, and
watch that show.
What also represents a mentality. What he's doing is reflecting back and helping to propagate a mentality among the 14 people that watch MSNBC. But then all the other outlets that pick up this sort of commentary and amplify it. I mean, that is just such a. So a couple of things. It's not just about January 6th. January 6th was the opening shot of the insurgency in Malcolm Nance's mind. And the last 2 years have been a white supremacist inspired insurgency against our democracy. And now we're to the point, according to Malcolm Nance, where we're going to have to suppress this insurgency through force. How else do you interpret his words? They're pretty straightforward. So I don't know. I guess I would ask and encourage you to ask people on the left that you know that you can have a civil conversation with. And I understand those ranks are fewer and fewer with each passing day. Is that what you think? The level of agitprop there. Your neighbors who are Republicans are going to kill you. That's what Malcolm Nance said. They're going to kill you because they are part of a white supremacist inspired insurgency.
I better not be Block Captain anymore. You want to take over the Block Party on August 20th?
Good God.
And that's not helpful, obviously.
Is that how we bring the country how we bring the country together?
312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line.
Who believes this stuff other than Malcolm Nance? But I mean that I asked that question rhetorically, but the answer is there's a lot of people.
I know.
You know, you got to look both ways before you cross the street. There could be a white supremacist inspired Republican who's there to kill you. I mean, come on with this. Terry in Rogers Park.
Yeah, I'm afraid if America ever has a fascist government takeover and only military and law enforcement are allowed automatic weapons, law-abiding citizens won't be able to fight back if all they're allowed to have is pistols. An armed society is a polite society.
Thanks for the call, Terry. Yeah. Well, and it was an interesting data point the other day about the increase in gun ownership among women. And again, with all this running around talking about semi-automatic weapons, they represent 85% of the guns in circulation and thus 85% of the gun owners. Yeah,
that's a big gun buyback program, Dan.
85% of the guns in the hands of gun owners, yeah. And right and it's across the board demographically and geographically. It's just silliness. But there's just so much silly. It's one thing to be, you know, a silly sentimentalist, you know, barbaric in that way. It's another thing to issue a call to arms against Republicans who are roaming around looking to kill you. And by the way, I can't emphasize enough, and you're a former naval officer.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. I mean, is that the price of...
What kind of training did he get?
Is that the price of having that... sinecure on MSNBC so you can write and sell books and feel like you're important? I mean, and by the way, you know, we have some people like that in the conservative ranks, not saying that sort of thing, but, you know, who will play the role to have a sinecure where they have more status so they can sell books and live a happy life. They're not adding anything to the conversation either, but Malcolm Nance... is a disgrace.
Well, did anybody try and stop him? Like, what do you know?
Stop him? That's why he's on. David in Winnetka.
Yeah, Dan, Amy, good morning. I was a staunch lefty in 2020, and then I started looking around at observable reality. And now, as my punishment, I get up every morning and punch myself in the face 10 times to start my day. Possible that anybody with half a brain can't look around and say, my God, I've been duped. I mean, it's insane. Anyways, that's all I have to say. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks for the call, David. Appreciate
it.
Always enjoy hearing from the converts. Art in Woodstock.
Morning, Dan and Amy. You're talking about Malcolm Nance. There's a competing radio station out of Chicago with Stephanie Miller as the host. And they hold on to every word he says like as if it's gospel,
sure.
And he's a god.
He's a counterterrorism expert.
You should hear the way they. You should hear the way they talk, and this is a nationwide radio station. It'll blow your mind the way they talk about the right and the Trump supporters and white America. It's amazing. I can't believe their radio station's even on the air anymore. It's disgusting.
Thanks for the call, Art. I want their station on the air. I mean, I want Malcolm Nance to say what he thinks on the airwaves because I don't want this to be done in private. I don't want this to be hidden. You should hear it. It's always better when people show you who they are. Always better. You have a much better understanding of what's happening. Rick in Woodstock.
I just wanted to bring up that one of the things he was saying is he didn't sound like he was making any difference between white Republicans and white Democrats. He was saying 30% of the population wants to overthrow your government and does not believe in the democratic process at all. He says that directly on his comments there.
Yeah, no, I know, and, but I think it I think it's pretty clear he's saying 30% of Americans and they're all white Republicans because white Republicans are the Sinn Féin of American politics.
I mean, yeah,
white Republican males.
Yeah, yeah.
You guys.
I think you'd have a hard time finding 30% of Irish people that support Sinn Féin, and you know, so it's. Like you said, it's good to hear it from the horse's mouth, but the fact that they're this is who they want to hear from is alarming.
It should be. Thanks for the call, Rick. Mark, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, morning. I just got done laughing at that previous caller's comment about getting up and punching himself in the face. That was funny. It's a nice way to start the morning. Anyway, I'm in sales, so I do spend a lot of time in my vehicle. And Tom Hartman, who is opposite Dennis Prager on AMA 20, you guys, this guy has been nibbling around the edges with this type of rhetoric for years, even when Trump was in office. It's alarming. And now they're becoming more emboldened. And as that previous caller right before me, Stephanie Miller, this stuff has been going on, you guys, just because I'm in the car all the time. The stuff they say is absolutely jaw-dropping. It truly is. And then one other point, do you guys remember after January 20th that you had it was some famous or well-known cartoonist that had indicated that that Trump supporters were rats? I don't know if you remember that, but it was – this is the stuff that they've been saying and putting out there for a lot longer than Malcolm Nance.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Appreciate it. I'm glad we got a couple of people that listen to the socialist station, so we don't have to sort of our, you know, men on the other side there. Thanks for reporting back. Good intel. Bob in Paloma, Michigan.
Yes. Good morning, Dan and Amy. I was listening to the radio the other day. And I realized that AOC has joined the conservative side. She was calling for an investigation into the Capitol Police for opening the doors to the people who went in and carried on their mayhem.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. Thanks for the call, Bob. And as soon as they're done with that investigation, she'll defund them. Tom in Deer Park.
Well, hey, Dan and Amy, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I didn't hear the entire Malcolm Nance thing, but as you have said repeatedly, you call the hearings a star chamber, and you repeatedly said you don't listen to them, and most of your call-in people and Twitter people say they don't listen to them. So that tells me one thing, that their minds are made up. I'll say this for you, Dan. You're smart enough to know better because you have a list of probably a dozen or 50 or 100 people from the conservative ranks that could come on your show for five segments and tell you otherwise, but you don't because you're running a propaganda outfit. And when you, I love you, but when you call a guy like Malcolm Nance a hack, that's rich. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for the call, Tom. There's somebody that's been radicalized by watching Malcolm Nance on MSNBC. It's sad. I remember, I'm old enough to remember Tom from Deer Park when he had 2 feet firmly planted on the ground. As far as conservatives, he's talking about like David French and Jonah Goldberg, the never Trumpers that are in liege with Tom. But by the way, I mean, David French is basically almost turned into a never Christian in addition to a never Trump. That's how far afield David French is from where he was a few years ago. And unlike what Tom accused me of, we have had those individuals on the show for years and we've argued with them. I've argued back and forth with David French and Jonah Goldberg and Kevin Williamson many times and at our summits. So Tom from Deer Park, and I listened to Tom from Deer Park, and if people want to disagree, I'm always welcome to disagreement. In fact, I encourage it. So that's a lie from somebody who's become a professional liar because he's brain has been addled by the anti-Trump hysteria from the outlets that he consumes. Tom from Deer Park. It's sad, but that's what's happened, and it's a case study. And by the way, I am paying enough attention to January 6th hearings to know what is being said, what testimony is being offered. We have actually covered relevant testimony, particularly when the left wants to pretend that they have brought forward the smoking gun witness when they have not. And let me just restate for the record, Tom from Deer Park and your fellow travelers, those who have lost their minds, is who I'm talking about. The process is illegitimate. The process is illegitimate. Thus, the outcome cannot be legitimate. Just as, you know, these due process norms that the great saviors of our democracy are just so easily inclined to set aside. Due process. Equal protection before the law by people who are talking about prosecuting criminally a former president. No due process concerns. We don't care about due process norms now. We're the saviors of democracy.
It's a show. That's why they got primetime slots.
If you had a trial, a criminal trial, and this is something approaching it, where the accused was not allowed to present a case, was not allowed to have representation, would you say that is a fair trial?
No, that's a witch hunt.
No one would. And thus, no one would place any legitimacy in the outcome of that trial. That's a Stalinist show trial. That's what this is, the January 6th Commission. And that's what Tom from Deer Park and the fellow former conservative, libertarian, whatever, who, you know, have a basic understanding of economics but have completely lost the narrative about living in a free society. That's what they can't address, won't address, don't address. It's just all reckoning for Trump at any cost. In fact, it is people like Malcolm Nance and Tom from Deer Park. These are the ends justify the means crowd. They're the new authoritarians, or at least that's where they would take you were they able.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Smashing Pumpkins, or Pumpkins frontman Billy Corgan, announced that he and members of the band will be holding a benefit concert for the victims and families of Highland Park, where he's lived for the past two decades.
Good for him. Yeah. He's a nice man.
Yeah, no, I met him.
He used to be our neighbor, and I met him. He was so down to earth and humble and just normal.
Yeah, I met him once at a Cubs game, and he was a nice guy. He's shockingly tall.
Yes, people always think, yeah.
Shockingly tall.
He started a minor wrestling league, like a pro. I met Pondo. Remember Pondo from the old WWE? He's Billy Corgan. He started this other league, like their farm team. Invited me out to it. It was at a barn in Elgin, and it was really cool.
He's got varied interests. He has does he still have the tea shop in Highland Park?
I don't know.
He had a tea shop there. He's
a Renaissance man.
Wrestling. Okay.
Yeah.
One comment. It's just funny.
Okay.
You know, okay. So Billy Corgan announced the members of the Pumpkins family will be holding a benefit for the victims and families of Highland Park.
Awesome.
And one person on Twitter responded, those people have suffered enough.
Oh.
Come on. It's a little shot at the Pumpkins. It's all right.
It's not too
soon. Oh, God.
Okay.
It's a sense of humor. It has
nothing
to do with
Highland
Park. It's just about saying, yeah, he's not a fan of the Pumpkins music. Okay.
Yes.
You know, it's okay to have that position, for goodness sake. All right. I want to talk a little bit more of what we were talking about prior to Mike Scott's newscast, and that's with respect to the January 6th Star Chamber, these ridiculous comments about this ongoing insurgency from Malcolm Nance. And what's the predicate? The predicate is what happened in the November 2020 election. And so it's important because despite their inability to organize, to engineer a federal takeover of elections, the Biden administration is trying to do through the back door what they couldn't get through the front door, We saw this with COVID policy. We can't get it through Congress, so we'll just rely on our administrative agencies. Molly Hemingway was on with Tucker Carlson the other day talking about exactly this.
Yeah, so just as you said, President Biden issued an executive order telling all 600 federal agencies to submit plans about how they could engage in a federal takeover of elections. You might remember that when Democrats took control of the Senate and the White House, they had their signature legislation was a federal takeover of election administration. Now, they failed to do that. This appears to be something of a backup plan where they can get involved in all sorts of election-related activities using the bureaucracy. And there are so many problems with this. I mean, first and foremost, it's unconstitutional. The Constitution is very clear that it is given to state legislatures to handle election administration in their states. It's also really unethical. I mean, you noted that people are desperately trying to find out exactly what these plans are, and they're not being given details, but details are starting to come out, and it appears that at that point where government benefits meet with the people, they are taking advantage of that opportunity. You know, whether it's a homeless shelter or whether it's food distribution programs or health programs, as a way to do this federal overtaking of election administration. And it also is a recipe for chaos and confusion. Each state has different laws, and the idea that federal bureaucrats who don't even necessarily do a great job with what they're supposed to be doing could manage all those intricacies is, you know, it's delusional. And it's just a very disruptive thing to our system at a time when the entire country needs to have confidence and belief that the elections are secure.
Which is a perfect segue to our next guest, because if he wins his race for attorney general, this is going to be one of the issues on the docket, I would think. Tom DeVore is an attorney with Silver Lake Law, and he's also the Republican nominee for attorney general in the state of Illinois. Tom, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, good morning, sir.
So what about what Molly Hemingway describes and how much concern you ascribe to the issue she's raising about the administrative state trying to backdoor a federal takeover of elections?
Yeah, and this is the same thing we've been dealing with in the last 2 years. It's just a different issue, and it's the main concern that I've raised on all of these all along, is that, you know, what we're seeing here is a regression away from how we're supposed to govern. You know, the legislative branch of government is the one that's supposed to handle all of these issues. And when they don't move as fast as some people would like, because that's how it was intended to be, we find these executive branches, either directly or through their administrative agencies, doing these things. And that's going to get worse. And I always knew it was going to get worse. That's why the people have to put an end to that. And yeah, we have to accept that sometimes things aren't going to move as fast as we want, and that can cause problems. But, you know, those problems are worth the alternative, and the alternative is this abuse of executive power, whether directly or through the administrative agencies.
Is this something, I mean, you know, sort of right now as both a candidate as well as a lawyer and potentially the chief law enforcement officer of the state, is this something you're looking at even in advance of this November's election, November 8th election, about the administration of elections here with Governor Pritzker, who's happy to have the same regime in perpetuity that we had in 2020?
Yeah, you know, we've been talking about that amongst ourselves, watching really closely what the governor may try to do. As of yet, we haven't seen anything, but, you know, trying to play these games with how our elections work, it's extremely, extremely dangerous. And so, yes, we're paying attention to that.
Now, a few days ago, Governor Pritzker dropped vaccine and testing mandates for some professors and staff and students. And this, tell us why this happened. Because was this about science and data, or was this about another courtroom loss?
It was about political science. I mean, most people don't know, but on June 22nd, I filed on behalf of a bunch of clients in Madison County, Illinois, a lawsuit against about 11 or 12 colleges across the state, arguing that they can't do the vaccination and testing, et cetera. And the governor was a named defendant, and they were set to respond to that complaint here real soon. And the governor made this change. And many people that didn't even know that we had filed that case called me asking, what's going on? And I told them, you know, many people don't appreciate, Dan, Amy, is that the Fourth Appellate District in the case that we argued in front of them a few months ago about the children and the teachers, they ruled in that case that the governor alone absent some lawfully adopted administrative rule. That's the difference there, Dan. Lawfully adopted doesn't have the power to enact any of this stuff. Mm-hmm. It was in the appellate court's decision. The Supreme Court didn't overturn it. And so the governor knows that. And given that we're in this election cycle, he can't afford to lose another argument in a courtroom like that. And so he rescinded that whole part of his executive order to get himself out of that lawsuit because he knew that they said he doesn't have the authority. So that's the only reason he did it. There was no other basis for it whatsoever.
But what about this underlying interpretation of the disaster declaration power the governor has, where you can just do an endless series of 30-day emergency orders like the 31 in a row that he's done? How can that be a fair interpretation of the statute?
It's absolutely 100%. Well, I should say 99 because we've got the Foxfire case. Not an interpretation of the statute. If I'm the attorney general, that issue will go to the Illinois Supreme Court because as of right now, we've got an interpretation out of the Foxfire case, out of the second, that says that is. They said, if you read their opinion, Dan, they say there was no question. It's absolutely ridiculous. And again, with all due respect to that appellate court, it makes no sense whatsoever. And it should be changed either by the Supreme Court or the legislature needs to change that. And yeah, that's been the biggest abomination of the last 2 years is these serial proclamations of disaster, which keeping in mind, Dan, is a separate issue of regardless of that 30-day serial proclamation, what is the extent of his emergency power?
Yeah,
that's
right.
A separate and independent question. And he's lost a few of those arguments as to the extent of his power. It's not unlimited.
And I want to ask him, what's the emergency? I mean, people are at concerts. People are going on with their lives. I don't even, you know, what's he going to say?
There is no emergency. The reality is, and we all know, the governor continues to issue those disaster proclamations for a couple of reasons, but primarily to keep the federal funding coming so he can pontificate across the state how great our budget is from all those billions of dollars of COVID relief money.
Although Cook County, according to the CDC, has moved back into the high category for COVID transmission, whatever
what,
that is.
What color is that, Dan? It's chartreuse.
I think it's avocado green. 5,138 new COVID cases. I thought they weren't counting cases anymore.
She said they
were. But here, listen to what you said there, Dan. It's important. The CDC said.
Yeah, right.
All of that information is completely wiped off of the Illinois Department of Public Health website. I want it back. I want them to put all of that information on the IDPH website. I want the people to see that, yeah, we're in a particular period potentially where the virus is spreading again, and I want to watch Pritzker do nothing because of the election cycle. That will show his phoniness right there. Put it all back on the website and let us watch the daily transmission rate again like they were putting in front of our face every day this time last year. They won't do it.
Oh, my God. And also, what is school going to look like in the fall? I mean, how many school districts are still going to be testing, you know, test to stay, or if you're not vaccinated and you have a close contact, do you have to be quarantined?
A handful of them. I mean, we're still going to fight. We have a final hearing in our case on August 10th in Sangamon County. But, you know, right now of the 850-some school districts, public school districts, there's only two or three or four of them that at least I'm involved with that are still trying to do this stuff. Overwhelmingly across the state, they're not even talking about these things, which, again, the governor just has to accept that as a reality because his state power, just as he did with the vaccination and testing in the college cases, he's not going to try to reconstitute that state power. He already lost in the fourth on that, but he can't take the political risk of that. So he's going to let CPS and a few of those other northern districts who are being controlled by the Illinois Education Association and the National Association, he'll let them try to do what they want to do and fight with me a little bit. But overwhelmingly, it'll be a non-issue for most school districts across the state.
I took note this week, Oak Park became an abortion sanctuary community.
What's their color and ribbon?
What's the point? We have abortion on demand.
We have
abortion on demand that's taxpayer funded in Illinois. But okay. But it reminded me, Tom, about these sanctuary communities now or sanctuary state when it comes to illegal immigration and cooperation with federal law enforcement. What is your position and explain your understanding of the extent of your power were you to be attorney general on dealing with Illinois' status as a sanctuary state when it comes to immigration and illegal immigration?
You know, I've looked at that some. It's an interesting topic for me. You know, I'm 100% about the law. And, you know, what the law says, absent constitutional issues, is what I follow. And if I don't like it, I ask the legislature to change it. But, you know, being a sanctuary state just as a citizen has never made any sense to me. I mean, you know, we have federal laws. We need to respect our federal laws and enforce them unequivocally. And, you know, if I'm the attorney general, I'm going to follow the federal law. And if the federal law says we participate and we help, the attorney general's office is going to help. And, you know, if there's a state law that says that there's some sanctuary, you know, law enforcement doesn't have to participate, et cetera, the attorney general's office is not bound by that. And we will follow the law unequivocally.
And you should tell our listeners you recently had an Ogden poll. And where does it show you in the race with Kwame?
We are pretty close to Kwame. Actually, we're almost within the margin of error right off the bat. So I think that's outstanding at this point in time in the state of Illinois.
It is. And it speaks to the environment, too, where the generic ballot discrepancy between Democrats in favor of Democrats has winnowed to almost nothing, which is good news if you would like to see a change in leadership in the state, including Attorney General. Tom DeVore is the Republican nominee for Attorney General and attorney with Silver Lake Law. Tom, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Have a good day.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, as the United States confronts the threats posed by both Russia and China, one has to occasionally do a stop, look, and assessment. Do we really understand who we're dealing with? Don't you get that feeling? You should get that feeling because
you know who your enemy is.
So many of the miscalculations by the foreign policy establishment, the CFR folks inside the Beltway for so many generations now. Stephen F. Cohen was a renowned Russian studies professor at Columbia and NYU. He's now since passed, but he gave a talk at the Carnegie Council. This is 12 years ago. This is back in 2010, discussing Russia and Russia's view on NATO expansion. And this is particularly relevant, not only because of our financing Ukraine's efforts to repel the Russians, but also because, of course, we've expanded NATO to include Sweden and Finland now. Take a listen.
NATO expansion is not over for the Russians. It's a reality. NATO's sitting on its borders. It's not about future NATO expansion. It's about current. NATO expansion represents the following to Russia. And on the near this, I will end. It represents a profoundly broken promise to Russia made by the first Bush that in return for united Germany and NATO, NATO would not expand eastward. This is beyond any dispute. People say, well, they never signed a treaty. But a deal is a deal. The United States gives its word unless we're shysters. And if you don't get it in writing, we'll cheat you. We broke our word. And when both Putin and Medvedev say publicly to Madeleine Albright and others, we, Russia, feel deceived and betrayed, that's what they're talking about. So NATO represents, on the part of Russia, a lack of trust. You break your words to us. To what extent can we trust you? Secondly, it represents military encirclement. If you sit in the Kremlin and you look out at where NATO is and where they want to go, it's everywhere. It's everywhere on Russia's borders. But there's something even more profound that's a taboo in the United States. NATO expansion represents for the Russians American hypocrisy and a dual standard. And they see it this way, and I can't think of any way to deny their argument. The expansion of NATO is the expansion of the American sphere of influence. plain and simple. Where NATO goes, our military force goes. Where NATO goes, our arms munitions go, because they have to buy American weapons. Where NATO goes, Western soldiers go, who date their women. They bring along their habits and all the other things. It's clearly, undebatably, indisputably, an expansion of America's sphere of influence. So there has been a tremendous expansion of America's sphere of influence since the mid-1990s, right plunk on Russia's borders. All the while, every administration, American administration, saying to Russia, including the Obama administration, you cannot have a sphere of influence because that's old thinking. Well, I mean, the Russians may be cruel, but they're not stupid. In other words, what they say is we can now have the biggest sphere of influence the world's ever seen, and you don't get any, not even on your own border. In fact, we're taking what used to be your traditional sphere of influence, along with the energy and all the rest. It's ours now.
You know, some people interpret that as sort of being an apologist for Putin or the Russian communists. I don't think that's correct at all. I think that's somebody giving you a sober assessment of how a adversary to this country thinks, which should inform the strategic decisions you make. And I'm not sure that with respect to China and with respect to Russia, we've got a foreign policy establishment that has the proper understanding of the threats America faces informing their strategic decision making. For more on this, pleased to be joined by John O'Neill. He's a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy. He's also a Vietnam veteran. He served as a clerk for former Chief Justice William Rehnquist. And he's the New York Times bestselling author of The Dancer and the Devil, Stalin, Pavlova, and the Road to the Great Pandemic. Very interesting sort of historical track here in this book. John O'Neill, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. It's an honor to be on your show.
So, implicating Stalin and Pavlova in the title of the book. So Pavlova was the ballerina that Stalin assassinated back in the Soviet era. And you trace that all the way up to the Putin era. Addressing what Professor Cohen had to say 12 years ago.
Well, first of all, I surely agree with you that American foreign policy has made a terrible mistake in allowing Russia and China to become allies. Our entire policy beginning in the Nixon period was to try and separate Russia and China. You have a world with three great powers, the United States, Russia, and China. And we always, the split between China and Russia is in many ways what allowed the West to actually go forward. And, of course, because of our policy, which has been anti-Russian, we've driven the Russians into the hands of the Chinese. They have a military alliance now, and they're kind of best buddies. And that is a very dangerous thing for us. It's particularly dangerous because in China, Xi Jinping is the most fanatical Chinese ruler. Many years ago, I represented, China and a lot of litigation in the United States. I withdrew after they killed all the kids at Tiananmen Square and never again represented them. But what happened at Tiananmen Square is the entire government of China changed in 1989 and the Maoists took over. Deng Xiaoping, who had been sort of a moderate, was growing old. He kind of faded. And ever since that point, 1989 till now, particularly beginning in 2013 with the ascension of Xi Jinping as the head of China, China has become more and more radical and more classic Stalinist power. And that's kind of who we're facing now. We're facing a fanatic, and they followed the Stalinist model. People aren't even aware in the United States, but China's had a purge. Over a third of the people in the Communist Party have been executed, as they were in Stalinist days in the 1930s. The Chinese economy, people like Jack Mao and all, have all been removed from the companies that they founded, like Alibaba, and a tremendous number of them have simply disappeared. Likewise, in the arts, people like Fanny Bingbing, who was their greatest movie star, and any number of movie stars, all of a sudden, you just can't find them. They're just nowhere there. And so you have a you're facing all of a sudden a Stalinist expansionist power with one of the most important economies on earth that's very militant, and they're allied all of a sudden with the Russians.
And so,
of course, as you point out with Putin, feel very threatened.
And so you're essentially suggesting that Putin is the progeny of Stalin and Xi is the progeny of Mao.
Well, more complicated, actually, a little bit. I agree with you. But Mao took the position that Stalin was a great leader and that the Soviet Union should never disavow him.
Right.
That's what caused the split. And so if you study what Xi Jinping says, he says you can't be a good communist if you don't believe in Stalin. And I really see Stalin as sort of the rootstock of both, with Mao in later years turning to Stalin as sort of a mentor. But to me, the importance of Stalin is the belief that you had to control the entire mind of man, his culture, his language, every intimate detail of his life. It wasn't enough to simply control the means of production like, Engels and Lenin thought. You actually had to wipe out religion. You had to control the words people spoke. You had to wipe out the word God. You had to control which ballet was actually put on which movie. And that
limit the number of children.
Absolutely. Limit in China the number of children. Today, of course, the Communist Party is inserting people in major industries and control them, which is probably why their economy slipped 2.6% in the last quarter after growing so rapidly in the past.
And at this point, what's China's biggest threat right now to America?
Oh, there's no question. They've moved on and taken over Hong Kong, which was once a wonderful and fabulous city and is now just part of a police state. And it's very clear that they're going to move on our friends in Taiwan. How and the moment is the only question, but they're coming for sure. And, of course, they've become expansionists. The first expansionist China that we've seen in, 500 or 600 years, guided by an ideology that's partly nationalism, partly Stalinism, and partly communism, and incredibly self-righteous. And so they pose a tremendous threat to our friends in Japan, for example. They absolutely hate the Japanese. And if they have an opportunity to take over South Korea or Japan, they're going to do it.
These words are used interchangeably, but there are important distinctions. You mentioned partly Stalinism, partly communism. Distinguish those two.
Well, communism, classic communism, Engels and Marx said that if you controlled the means of production, the banks, land, and the like, that people's beliefs would naturally follow. And so if I control banks and the government ran them, why, people would fall away. They wouldn't believe in religion anymore. That would be silly. They wouldn't believe in X or Y or whatever, and culture would naturally follow. By the Stalin days, the Soviet Union had tried the new economic program. It failed in the 1920s, and so they actually had to go to sort of a mixed, for a time, a mixed capitalist system. And then Stalin, as he accumulated power, together with an ideologue named Anton Gramsci, conceived that it was necessary to control culture, language, and so on. And the first great cultural revolution occurred not in China, but in Russia, 1928 to 1930. 175,000 Orthodox priests were killed in 1927. Stalin outlawed the use of the word God in Russia, by way of example. Stalin purged the ballet in Russia itself, and then even went outside Russia, and as the book outlines, killed Pavlova and others, often by poisoning, using a deal called Lab One. And so classic communism involved control of physical assets. So
Stalinism involves control of the mind of people.
Mm-hmm.
It involves your show would be gone in 2 seconds, and there'd be a guy on your
right.
show.
So we'd be sitting right next to Solzhenitsyn. I know. So the road to the great pandemic, Stalin, Pavlova, right. and the road to the great pandemic. So you know, now connect that dot for us.
All right. What happened is Stalin in 1921 began a poison lab. It expanded into a huge bioweapons facility in a place called Saratov in Russia. That bioweapons facility leaked, and the leaks are outlined in the book and are acknowledged. They expanded into the Ukraine bioweapons, for example, anthrax, are spores. Well, Stalin, on a retail basis, used spores, the injection of spores into lungs by people breathing it to simulate pneumonia, and people would die, and it would be analyzed as pneumonia was actually the use of anthrax. And there was a project in Russia called the Anthrax Project that developed it. In Soviet days, it became a huge project, billions of dollars a year going into that project. And likewise in China. China had 15 different bioweapons labs. These are disclosed in a book by the number two guy in the Russian project, a guy named Albeck, who wrote a book called Bioweapons. Well, it leaked repeatedly in Russia and killed a lot of people, the most famous in Yekaterinburg in 1979. Of course, when the COVID deal occurred, the question was, where did it come from? We had a virus that had never been found and has never been found on Earth outside of its occurrence right outside the bioweapons and weapon and biolabs in Wuhan, China. And, of course, we knew instantly where it came from, because anybody that studies the history of it knows where it came from. It was a created virus, and the book takes you through the actual evidence of it. There's a great deal more evidence now.
You have no doubt in your mind that the COVID came from the Wuhan virology lab.
I tried hundreds of cases, and I always used to tell my clients it was a 20% chance we'd lose, even in the best case. This is 100%er. I'd win this case every single time. In front of any jury, any fair jury at all in the world. Yep. There's absolutely no doubt that's where it came from.
And what's your best evidence?
The very best evidence is it occurred immediately outside the lab. The second piece of evidence is that all the records of it, of how it came about, were destroyed in China. And the guy who discovered it and reported it was arrested and imprisoned for disclosing state secrets, Dr. Wei. And he then supposedly died of COVID. It was very clear that he was murdered. It's not the first time that the Chinese biolabs have leaked. In 1977, the book outlined how they leaked, how the Chinese claimed it never happened, how 700,000 people died, and then how the head of the Chinese virology program in 1994 admitted that they had leaked it, leaked the 1977 flu, while they were in the process of trying to develop a vaccine as a bioweapon. And so there's a great deal more evidence in the book, but it's kind of the obvious to start off with. And then there's the concealment of evidence is powerful evidence. The occurrence, there used to be, and there is in law, a statement, res ipsa loquitur, the thing speaks for itself.
Right.
When a flu virus of unknown origin, never be located anywhere in the world, appears directly at a bioweapons lab, my goodness, aren't we all smart enough to know, just like, that it's very obvious what has happened?
We have a hard time.
The book outlines a great deal of additional evidence.
Yeah, we have a hard time using the past to inform the present, even when there is, ample relevance of the past with, for example, Russia and China. That's why the history is so important. I don't know. People just compartmentalize in a way that's difficult to describe. On the one hand, you know that these countries have been run by murderous thugs for, 100 years in Russia's case, centuries in China's case. And yet you think they're on the up and up when it comes to, a contagious virus or business dealings or academic investments or investing money in the president's or at the time the vice president's son and so on and so forth. It's all very innocent. We're going to liberalize China by doing business with them. That was the thought. And in it turns out, it seems to me, get your opinion, that what we really did was just sort of underwrite their rise.
Madness. Dan, two-thirds of our pharmaceuticals are now produced in China. Two-thirds of the medicines that every American takes or Americans take are all now produced in China. 10 years ago, they were produced in the United States or Puerto Rico. And we created a system that favored China that allows basically all two-thirds of our medicines to be created there in the very same country that has now infected the entire world in the course of trying to develop a bioweapon. And our foreign policy has been absolutely insane. We started hoping that China would develop into a democratic country, but it was obvious from Tiananmen Square forward that was never going to happen. And since then, we've just fed the lion. We fed the tiger, hoping someday that the tiger would be happier and nicer or grateful. And it's sort of like letting the murderer out of jail on the theory he'll be grateful. It's just absolutely crazy. And so our foreign policy has made no sense for a long time in the United States.
He is John O'Neill. He's a graduate of the Naval Academy, Vietnam vet, also served as a clerk for former Chief Justice William Rehnquist. The book, bestseller, The Dancer and the Devil, Stalin, Pavlova, and the Road to the Great Pandemic. John O'Neill, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed very much being on your show, Dan. Thank you.
Very informative. And he joined us on our Turnkey Pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The answer.
Dan and Amy, again, make sure your thinking cap is firmly affixed, because we go from John O'Neill's discussion of Russia and China to Professor Richard Epstein. A few topics to discuss, including a recent Seventh Circuit decision on Obamaland, or I guess what's called the Obama Presidential Center. Judge the Seventh Circuit upholding the decision for the Obamaland to stay in Jackson Park.
What about all the trees?
Well, what about the rule of law is the question raised by Professor Epstein. Review that was done, the impact, and then there's other issues too, including what makes aesthetic and aesthetic sense in even environmental sense. Without further ado, Richard Epstein is the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Law and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago, and long considered by people a lot smarter than me one of the great legal minds of the 20th century in this country. Professor Epstein, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I hope I can continue into the 21st. Yes, I mean, look,
you're
still a great legal mind of the 21st, yeah, too. Sorry about
yes,
that.
Yes, I mean, I will have to say, I mean, I've been working on this case now for over 3 years, and it's one of the most thankless endeavors I've ever had. The last decision that came down from the Seventh Circuit was a bitter disappointment. It was totally wrong with respect to every point. It never got to the question of whether or not, if you were to put into place saplings some 5 years from now, you could have a one-to-one ratio of saplings for trees and make no difference in the way in which the overall system operated. They just didn't seem to touch it. What they did is they went off on a couple of very technical points. One has to do with the standard of review, and the second has to do how it applies to an arcane document known as segmentation. And on the first particular point, the standard, which was not quoted in the opinion, was set down in a case called Overton Park, over 50 years ago, in which they said that a court has to do a thorough examination to make sure that the agency looked at every one of these kinds of issues. And what they did, in effect, is they said, well, the agency gave a hard look, so we don't have to look at anything. And what they then did is, why does this make a difference? Well, the question is, what is the project that's at stake? If you look at the official documents put out by the government, it's ordinary English. It says what we are trying to do is to put a presidential center smack dab in the middle of Jackson Park. We're going to have to expand two roads, close a third road, cut down 1,000 trees, and so forth. And so you would look at this project as a whole. The regulations under the National Environmental Policy Act make it very clear that you can't duck this kind of an examination by fragmenting the particular project into two projects. But that's exactly what Judge Wood did in her opinion. She said the decision to build the Dawn Center is something which was not subject to federal approval. The decision to close the roads was not subject to federal decision. So we're going to assume that they have a blank slate on that. And then the rest of the project, which is completely integrated with the former, is how do we make adjustments in the park once we are given that the center is going to be built there? Well, the only thing you could do then is to change the way in which the roads are going to be configured. And that's exactly what she looked at. And she said they picked the right configuration for the roads. But you can't basically say that we're going to look at the treat the center as a given and then do the roads. You have to take the whole project. And once you take the whole project, the question is not how you fix up the roads at the edge of the park. The question is whether this entire thing should be built at all. And what happened is we commissioned the study by a great architect named Bram Balcony. And what he did is he found a better plan, much more distinguished architecturally, won a major national award, to be done on a site not on public lands but on private lands just to the west of Washington Park, has great access to public roads, public transportation, and everything. And by segmenting the project, they never once mentioned the fact that there was, oh, this thing going on in Washington Park.
Well, I just want to be clear on this. So in Diane Wood, she's a judge on the Seventh Circuit. In her opinion, she did not contemplate the alternatives that have been presented.
She said you don't have to look at them. What she did is she said we are fatally flawed. She said NEPA only reaches major federal actions, not actions of non-federal actors. Well, that's just 100% wrong. What she's saying, in effect, is the entire private sector is going to be exempt from NEPA. On the entire government action, state government action? No. The provision is any private project that you want to put up is going to be subject to federal review if it's supported by federal funds. And there's very clear authority that since money is fungible, you can't say, well, we're devoting the money to one part of this project and not to the other and escape the review. But she never goes through that particular analysis. She assumes that this segmentation could take place as a matter of right, and she does so because of a wrong argument. She says the federal government cannot dictate where the center can be built. And that's exactly correct. It can't dictate it, but the entire purpose of the NEPA regulation is that it can forbid its construction in certain places unless you go through certain kinds of examinations. And they never went through the examination of the two alternative sites because what they did is they segmented. And we cited case after case where segmentation was regarded as impermissible, and all of this stuff was just there. This is an opinion which spends about 4 or 5 pages on a major issue, and it's wrong on every single point that she discussed. I mean, you sit there as a lawyer wondering, what are you supposed to do? And it gets even crazier because there's also the financial side of this case having to do with the public trust doctrine, which we're now faced before Judge Blakey down below. And he makes erroneous ruling after erroneous ruling and doesn't give us the right to appeal, even though the legal issues on the two points are completely distinct one from another. So what we're now basically trying to do is to figure out how you get yourself out of this procedural chokehold in an effort to try to get fresh views on this. It's very difficult to get the Supreme Court to take the environmental case because they don't take many cases. But this is the single worst decision ever decided on NEPA. And I am not a friend of NEPA. I have criticized it time after time for stopping major construction of railroads, ports, and so forth. And the reason is these things have to be built, and there are real physical constraints as to where you could build a road or a tunnel and so forth. The Obama Center is a freestanding subject. You could put that anywhere. Right. And there's absolutely no inconvenience to moving it to west of Jackson.
Jackson Park. It's a less fancy address. It doesn't have the view of the lakefront. It doesn't ruin a world-class national park. And so what the court does is it just turns a blind eye to all of the objections and essentially gives you wrong propositions of law, which allow them to read an indefensible conclusion.
President Obama wanted it there because he lived there once, so he's being a little selfish. But talk about the aspect that how the Obama Center is going to push out black families.
Well, it's not going to push out anybody. It's not going to help anybody. This thing is built in a cul-de-sac. The real problem about this is how you're going to get through a single entrance all of the customers whom you want to come, all of the patrons, all the employees, all the security personnel, all the supplies, all the deliveries. They have only one portal. And you go in one way, then you have to go back out the other way. If you built this thing west of Jackson Park, you get public transportation, ease of entry in and out, or you get 1,000 times better. So they're going to put up a center there, and they won't possibly be able to service it or to get anybody to come into it. They're not displacing anybody, but they're not helping anybody either. You put this thing west of Jackson Park, you could look at the map, and there's vacant land after vacant land on which small businesses could grow and could feed off the center. And that's exactly what happened with the Clinton Center when they put that in Little Rock. But this particular thing is just going to hang there alone. There's no way that you can put something in Jackson Park and hope to stimulate commerce that has to take place 2 or 2.5 miles away across the city. So the whole conception is crazy. They constantly say how they're going to boost traffic in Hyde Park. Well, it turns out if you look at the Museum of Science and Industry, which is vastly larger, it doesn't boost anything at all for Hyde Park. People come, go to the place, and then leave. They don't want to come into Hyde Park because you have to walk 3/4 of a mile to get a meal. They'll eat it inside the building. So they make these extravagant claims about this, and at the same time, they don't publish their financial records now, which would indicate, if you look closely at them, they're out of pocket by well over $1 billion of the monies they're supposed to have in order to fund this thing. And what Judge Blakey did is he said, oh, we were trying to sue as a third party who benefits under the contract, and then gives a summary judgment against us 12 hours after we file our papers, where in fact what we said is they can't go with this project at all because they haven't met the financial condition. We're trying to figure out how to appeal that case as well. We're not giving up on this stuff. It would be just a public disgrace to back off of something which is so utterly deficient in terms of both its environmental aspect and its financial aspect.
Well, so here, I mean, you're not a babe in the woods. When you're talking about NEPA, you're talking about National Environmental Policy Act. So, I mean, it's what's happening here, both at the district level as well as the appellate level, isn't what's happening here. You have a former president, a lot of political clout, the political power structure in Chicago in unison, and they're going to bootstrap whatever arguments they need to bootstrap to continue to give the green light to this project.
Well, that's the reality of it. But the point about this is we still have to fight, and there are at least two reasons. One is they've cut down several hundred trees, but they haven't cut them all down. It's also very clear under the law that if you build something which is illegal at the time that it's put up, you have to take it down. Oh. And the other point is they now have eyes to figure out how they're going to put a golf course in Jackson Park. And the more we can fight on this, the less likely it is that they'll be able to wreck a perfectly good golf course in order to satisfy the titanic ego of a former president.
It's all about ego. What he wants.
Thank you for that update on the former president. Give us a bit of an update on the current president, because you wrote a piece a few weeks ago about Biden and the ghost of the great Milton Friedman, and how Milton Friedman might respond to the tinkering, the monetary and fiscal policy tinkering of this administration, this president, Jay Powell,
okay,
and the like.
Well, let me first make a correction. Okay. To use the word tinker is to underestimate by a factor of 1,000 the kind of dislocations that this president is trying to put with respect to the economy.
Yeah.
He's basically a warmed-up version of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, the worst features of both. He is an economic illiterate. As I said in one of the pieces I wrote, it's amazing how many people can beat Milton Friedman in an argument when he's not in the room, and that equally applies now that he's been dead for 16 years. Joe Biden knows nothing about
about anything. And what happens is he seems to think that whenever there's a problem, what you do is two things. You throw money, which is going to create inflation, and then you reduce efficiency. And so if you want to figure out why the system is so crazy, what we're trying to do is more and more through government action of transfer payments, most of which are ill-advised or stupid in one way or another, and we're doing it with a smaller economic base on which we can do this. And the whole thing is now starting to unravel. You're starting to see the fact that energy production in the United States is going to decline. And what are you going to put in its place? Solar energy, which is now 3% of total production at most, is highly limited in the way in which it can go. No, what you have to do is to figure out how to make fossil fuels more efficient. And it turns out there's a vast research program that allows you to do exactly that thing. You want to figure out how you're going to deal with COVID. What you have to do is to take a good, hard look at the science, something which he always says but never does. And you will now realize that whatever the virtues of the COVID vaccines, the mRNA vaccine, might have had back in 2021, it turns out now that these are very dangerous things, as best one can tell, and you have to rethink the whole program of how you're going to deal with disease containment. On the criminal law system, it's not generally his bailiwick and so forth, but he has certainly given no hope to people who want to think that the strict enforcement of the criminal law is something that we have to be able to deal with. His ability to support things like the social responsibility stuff having to do with the way corporations operate is going to be a total disaster. What happens is these new causes are not sustainable in any way, shape, or form. And what happens is we get a bully pope trying to basically change the way in which corporate investment takes place by having more and more control at the center. His fixation with global warming, which is relatively modest in the last 10 years, it's been at a high plateau compared to other times, but it's not rising. In fact, last year was the sixth warmest year that we had on record, which means that we've had five that have been warm. But they are trying to get the SEC to require everybody to make these ridiculous climate reports, which are of no value to investors. And then what they're trying to do is to shut down the pipelines in order to switch you to the solar energy. So it's just a complete comedy of errors falling apart. I can't think of a single thing that that man knows anything about. And his advisors, as best I can tell, just lead him around by the nose, and all of them are in fact very strong progressives to whom the words market economy are regarded as some kind of a fatal sin. So what you're looking at here is a genuine catastrophe in the way in which this country is running, and the quicker that we can get him and the Democrats out of power, the better. I've never regarded myself as a Republican. The reason is I'm not in favor of corn subsidies for Iowa and things like that. But I am a classical liberal, and in politics you choose the lesser of two evils. And at that particular point, whatever the faults that the Republican Party has, they're modest in comparison with the fatal defects that you see on the other side.
That is a spectrum. That's about as good a summation of the Biden years as you're going to get. I got one question before I let you go. If people were interested in Richard Epstein's scholarship and they wanted to get an introduction, what would be one of the books that you've written that you would recommend, an introduction to you?
The book for, I think, a general audience is a book called Simple Rules for a Complex World.
That's great.
And I wrote it 27 or so years ago. And basically what it did is generalize from the great insights of Red Auerbach. You have to look at this. He says, you're playing basketball. He says, you understand the floor is flat and the ball is round. Those are very simple constraints, but it's only with that kind of system that you could actually play the game, right? And so in order to run the world, what you have to do is to make sure that your rules, your floors are flat and your balls are round. And this means that the larger the social interactions, the greater the kinds of complexities you have, the simpler rules and that you have to put into place. Now, simple rules become complicated when things start to go wrong, but we don't want to worry about the complications. What we want to do is to get the error rate down. So if you're thinking about how you run a highway system, you don't say, let's have a probabilistic distribution of where cars can go at any time. You have bright lines, you have lanes, and you design the system so that no two cars can be at the same place at the same time, right? And the liabilities attached to those people who deviate from the rules. So that's a very simple system for torts. In contracts, essentially, if people tell you they want to be able to hire and fire or to quit at will, that's exactly what they should be able to do. And that means you get rid of the anti-discrimination laws, the minimum wage law, the Fair Labor Standards Act, the National Labor Relations Act.
all of these things detract from in a competitive economy. And the third thing you have to worry about under simple rules is where markets do break down. And there are many such cases. Pollution is a case, overfishing and overhunting common pool resources as such. And so what you try to do is to put into place a regime that limits the ability of people to engage in these activities and then gives them by way of compensation alternative rights in a system which is more productive. So you stop the unlimited capture of wild animals of one kind or another, and you start auctioning off permits so that people can take stuff out, and you put the permits in place so as to make sure that sustainable yields will be observable when you're dealing with fish or wildlife or hunting or anything else. And you put the system together, it actually works.
All right. Don't give it all away. Don't spoil the end. There are simple rules for
complex. No, this is not a suspense novel.
Simple Rules for a Complex World is a book Richard Epstein recommends by Richard Epstein. I would also recommend Principles for a Free Society. He is the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Law, Senior Lecturer at University of Chicago. Professor Epstein, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye, thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We brought this to you a few days ago. This is York High School in Elmhurst. This recording of a teacher. The teacher references herself and another teacher, and I don't know which teacher is the one speaking. It's either Mrs. Deloria or Mrs. DiTommaso. And this was picked up by the Patch because, you know, they're rallying to defend these teachers from my meanness.
Here's toxicity.
What's that? Yeah, my toxicity, exactly.
In the public discourse. No, you're just stating. Well, you tell them what happened.
Well, first of all, note this: somebody thought it was important to record this teacher. I didn't do it.
And you didn't persuade anybody to do it.
No, I just received
this came
it.
To you, yes.
So take a listen.
We gave you his writing so that you could see his ideology. He wrote this stuff. I'm not making this up. Okay. But the problem is, some people, they tell little 5'2" Miss Deloria and Miss DiTommaso, you better keep those facts locked up in the closet. We don't want our kids to know that. I want to ask you why. When we think about values, what are the values that are in the words? And what are the values in the secret facts? Those things do not want to coexist, right? There's a problem there. And we saw a problem in the founding. And if we can understand that there was a problem then, we A, think of ourselves a little bit differently when we look in the mirror and say, oh, this guy is representative of all of us that are citizens of this country. We start to ask some questions, like if it wasn't true then, when did it become true, right? When were we living up to this? And that threatens certain values. There is a threat, okay? That threat, like, is the reason people do not want this story told.
So the whole posture here, she's talking about Jefferson and the founding fathers. And the whole premise here is like she is under threat and her colleague is under threat to not tell the secret truth about the founding fathers, that they were slave owners. We're not supposed to talk about. And it's just a lie. It's just a lie. They are ascribing to themselves the censorship that they practice, the stilted presentation of America's story that they practice. They're ascribing to others. They're the ones under threat. They're being censored. We don't want to hear the truth. Wrong. As I said when we first tackled this, find me someone who is opposed to the hyper-politicized, racialized, genderized curricula in schools. Use, for example, the critical race theory hustle. Fine for me if someone says, you can't talk about slavery. What my criticism is, I don't want to hear about slavery. I don't want to hear about the Chinese Exclusion Act. I don't want to hear about internment camps. I don't want to hear about Jim Crow. No, no one. You can't find anyone because it's not true. What we are suggesting is, you know, referring to Thomas Jefferson the way that apparently the docents at the Jefferson at Monticello do now, as some sort of, you know, he's a slave owner and he tinkered around the house.
Right. And he built University of Virginia.
I mean, as we're saying, is not a presentation of the totality of the man, of the time. Does it give you a textured understanding? It doesn't even raise interesting questions because it's such a cartoonish caricature.
They're shaming him in death for owning slaves.
And so here again, no one is trying to prevent anyone from providing and presenting the totality of the issues. In fact, we're encouraging it. And by the way, after we aired this, got an email. I won't give his name because I didn't ask if we could use it, but he's a former student at York. Mm-hmm. He's now moved on to Phoenix, Arizona, where he practices law. He said this, Miss DiTommaso, one of the teachers mentioned, was there while I attended and notoriously liberal. The notion somehow this department tried to obfuscate the history of Jefferson's past is absurd, and I can't imagine that the teacher's reference tried to hide anything of the sort given their penchant for pushing a very clearly settled narrative. He goes on. Oh, he said, this is a department that showed us the documentary Outfoxed, which was a hit piece on Fox News, with equally critical segment on the liberal bias of media. And that was back in 2012 or so. So in other words, they're presenting both sides. The social studies department was littered with liberal undertones, so much so that I sent an email to the department arguing to make it somewhat fair. It comes subtraction, but ultimately a pat on the head. Now, kiddo, you just don't understand yet. Same pretty much with every department. Human biology class having an entire week segment on global warming, or the English department providing a certain grade for someone who towed the line while others who critically analyzed such positions were not subject to such a favorable grading scale. And so anyway, he gives perspective there to suggest that these people suggesting they're being pressured or censored by conservatives, which is essentially the insinuation, to not tell the whole truth about America, warts and all. It's just a big lie. So that's the nature of it. For more on the topic of American history, K through 12 setting, please be joined by Joy Pullman, who's the executive editor of The Federalist, Federalist.com. Joy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi there. Good morning.
Morning. I note this example we have here locally in suburban Chicago. Runs concurrent with the ATF convention. This is where Randy Weingarten said, it's the same thing. She did the same thing the teachers are doing here at York, or that teacher. While extremist politicians are trying to drive a wedge between parents and teachers by banning books, censoring curriculum, and politicized public education, we're focused on investing in public schools and the essential knowledge and skills students need. And this was sort of a Orwellian way of continuing to of saying we're going to continue doing what we've been doing, regardless of who says what. And we'll just ascribe our behavior to our political opponents.
Well, that's because the teaching profession, I mean, honestly, since the very inception of the idea of separate teachers' colleges back in the early 1900s, has been a deeply leftist profession. And that doesn't obviously to say that every single teacher is a communist or something. There are many. You know, there's the whole spectrum among teachers, but they are not only, you know, more leftist than the general population by about 15 points, according to their self-reported surveys, but the institution, you know, itself, the professional associations such as the American Federation of Teachers, like you mentioned, the teacher education, the teacher licensing boards, those are all slanted heavily politically to the left. And the reason that is a problem is because, you know, as you point out, it's not the people on the right who want to hide the facts of history. It is the people on the left who are the book burners, the statue destroyers, who want to basically refuse to acknowledge the achievements of people and only focus on their flaws. And so rather than, you know, so when there is no check on that, when there's no discourse between the sides, when there's only the isolation of everybody on the right of the political spectrum, as you see leftists doing by every measure nowadays, then you have an imbalanced profession that teaches children falsehood.
Well, what should schools be teaching our children about American history and government?
Well, you know, there was an excellent actually recommendation for this put out for K-12 from a bipartisan coalition of very well-respected scholars at eminent institutions, collected kind of by the National Association of Scholars. And they put together a program of study for American history and government called American Birthright. Any person, I just did this the other day because I wanted to look up some of the books that they recommended to have my kids read over the summer. You can just Google, well, actually don't Google, use DuckDuckGo, but, you know, search up the term American Birthright, and that document will come right up for you. And I recommend that anyone who has any interest in what not only what kids are learning, but the future of this country, because what children learn is what's going to be the future of this country. If kids learn to hate their own country, they will grow up to destroy it. So if you don't want that to happen, if you think America's got a lot of good stuff going here that we want to preserve and improve upon, you know, you should be concerned about the education of the young and their own cultural heritage. So you can look up this document and bring it to your school board. You can, as I'm doing as a parent, my kids go to a Christian school that has an excellent curriculum, but, you know, they can't do everything in all those school hours, so I'm even supplementing with the recommendations from this organization. And any parent can do that or bring it to your school board as well.
Despite the parental revolt we've seen in pockets around the country against some of this hyper-racialized and stilted curricula, you still have the institutional control in the hands of the teachers' unions and their fellow travelers in the administrative positions. And you still have, I think, a majority of parents who are predisposed to give the benefit of the doubt to the kids in charge of the people in charge of their kids' education.
That's an excellent point. And I think that's because the system is actually truly designed to resist any efforts at this point from local citizens and parents to actually control what their kids are learning. And so when you see all these, you know, viral videos of parents rightly objecting to what's being taught, do you see in almost any, in a few isolated cases, sometimes school boards will make changes. But again, institutionally at the mass level, they absolutely are not going to do that. They're going to let you feel like you had your say, get your, you know, 2 minutes of you know, upsetness out at the school board meeting, thank you, and move on with exactly what was planned as if you'd never said anything. And we learned that, you know, for example, I mean, not just from the Common Core debacle, but that's a recent example of the exact same thing happening. Parents showed up, you know, local state school boards to their state lawmakers, and, you know, even when they got repeals, they were fake repeals that did essentially nothing, improved their kids' curriculum none, and the kids, you know, continued learning things that the parents objected to. So I don't know why parents should expect anything different. If you really want change, you have to do it yourself.
I just love this story, just to give you an example of sort of the inertia behind the powers that be. The Education Commission of the States awarded California Governor Gavin Newsom its Frank Newman Award for State Innovation. This is after California came in last in terms of the amount of in-person learning that occurred in the 2020-2021 school year. Came in last in in-person learning, locked it down, shut it down, kicked kids out. We know what the impact on that was, kids. There's lots of data on that now. And yet here's Gavin Newsom going to D.C. to be honored and you know, bring that home and use that as part of his presidential ambitions.
That's a total farce. It's an offense that a man who destroyed the education of so many children for so many years should be celebrated instead of honestly rode out of office by a horde of angry Americans. I think that really kind of shows, again, how corrupt our leadership is in this country, and our institutions have been, you know, again, basically our elites at this point use the goodwill of the people in order to undermine, you know, American voters' best interests. That's where things stand now. We have a situation similar to that, you know, when Teddy Roosevelt was president, of, you know, the corruption of big business, the incestuous nature between the two, where the people, you know, as designed, we have very little ability to govern ourselves, and that's by design. So we are given, you know, show you know, pretenses at being able to govern, you know, again, like with the 2 minutes, you go ahead, have your say, email your lawmaker, see if he changes his vote based on your input. You know what?
Right.
I mean, you know, it hasn't been like that for a very long time, and Americans feel that. And again, you know, the only response to that is to stop waiting for them to come in and solve your problems. If you have a problem, it's up to you, because ain't nobody else going to solve it. Gavin Newsom doesn't care about you. He doesn't care about children, but he's going to keep being put in office because, you know, frankly, people, teachers unions keep getting members and dues and pay, and all of, you know, the checks keep getting written to all of them, regardless of whether they, you know, intellectually and spiritually abuse children under their care or not. So yeah. We just saw them, you know, spend 2 years abusing children, and they're getting awards for that. That should tell you all you need to know about America's education system.
Well, and we need more parents to play the role of Maximus and say to all the commoduses in governor's offices and school boards and superintendents that the time for honoring yourself will soon be over. We'll see. We'll see how it plays out. Joy Pullman, executive editor of The Federalist, thefederalist.com. Joy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Open mic Friday. Call in now. Open mic Friday.
Dan and Amy, it's that time of the week. Open mic Friday, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. Taking your calls with comments, compliments, criticisms, general crack pottery. I've got a few housekeeping items, Amy.
Okay.
Number one, restaurants I will no longer be patronizing in Chicago. You shouldn't either.
Give it to me.
The Boca Restaurant Group. It's a big one.
Really? Why?
Celebrity chefs, Lee Wolin. He's at Ala Vida. Stephanie Izzard.
Okay.
You know, Girl and the Goat, right?
Oh, yep. Well, why not? What's going on?
Proceeds from the sale of every dry-aged beef tartare will benefit Planned Parenthood. The bottom of the Boca Restaurant Group menus.
Okay. Well, then we're not doing that. Bye-bye. It was proceeds. We had a good run.
Dry-aged beef tartare will be going to kill children.
Why
Wonderful.
Did they pick dry-aged beef tartare?
I don't know.
I mean, there's a lot of items to choose from.
So make sure you don't go. I mean, if you want to follow my lead. If you don't, then you're an American. You can do what you want. Go to Boca Group, BocaGRP.com, and you got a list of all their restaurants that I have patronized some. Will Never Again, Girl and the Goat, Ala Vida, Swift and Sons, GT Fish and Oyster, been there, Duck Duck Goat, Little Goat Dinner, Sugar Goat, a lot of goats. GT Prime Steakhouse, of course, in addition to GT Fish and Oyster. Yeah, all done. All done. Sorry. And not ordering the beef tartare is not quite enough. You know what I mean? I think you do. It's very much like we talked about these restaurants that were, you know, COVIDian enforcers of the state during the lockdowns.
Oh, yeah. Don't want to patronize them. Put a mask on to use the bathroom.
Don't want to patronize them either. All right. So that's one housekeeping item. The other is this fun little confrontation between our friend Alex Primetime Stein and the front girl for the Socialist Spice Girls, one AOC.
Uh-oh.
Alex Stein waiting for her on the Hill, traveled to D.C.
AOC, my favorite big booty Latina. I love you, AOC. You're my favorite. She wants to kill babies, but she's still beautiful. You look very beautiful in that dress. You look very sexy. Look at that booty on AOC. That's my favorite big booty Latina. I love it. My favorite, AOC. Nice to meet you, AOC. Look how sexy she looks in that dress. Woo, I love it, AOC. Hot, hot, hot like a tamale.
Oh, my.
AOC responded. She seemed to be playing along in the moment, but then she wasn't.
Hey, everybody. I'm here in the Capitol. See this guy right there? Right there. When I was walking up, he said, hey. Right in front of the Capitol Police officer. Hey, here's this. Look at that big ass. Look at that big juicy booty. This Latina, like whatever. You know, all the bunch of racist, sexist stuff. And since nobody can do anything.
Right.
I'm just telling you because this institution is not designed to protect people. And it's really hard and it's really sad that my only recourse
I don't feel safe.
Is to just let you know about it, but that's the institution we're in.
Oh, God. Oh, you're so put upon. She tweeted that she, like, wanted to deck him or something. Okay, we'll go deck him and see maybe if Capitol Police pay attention then. Yeah, you know, you're allowed to catcall. I mean, it's
just doing it for, I mean.
Right, of course.
Alex Stein 99. Primetime Stein.
Of course. Yeah,
does she know what he's about?
A YouTube provocateur. And AOC is, why didn't the Capitol Police protect me? Yeah,
she was walking up with a dog too. Whose dog was she's that? Just that's so weird.
I mean, honestly, I just
if she was 300 pounds and had acne, nobody would listen to a damn word she said. I maintained that all along.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. She is good looking. She should embrace it, but turn around and go, "Yeah, you're darn right."
I mean, that's like it's overstated because politics is show business for ugly people. So there's so few people that are
good looking
in politics. Oh, that
John Thune, please. Oh, Senator of South Dakota.
Or David Gergen. Smoke show. David Gergen.
I think David Gergen is hot. I've always had a crush on him.
I know. No, it's the complete lack of chin definition, the comb over.
Yeah.
75-year-old pasty honky. Oh, he's smoking. Oh.
Can we try to get him on the show?
Yeah, just so you
can.
But
what about Thune?
He's your celebrity crush, so sure, of course. Oh, Dorian Gray, John Thune? Yeah, okay. Eduardo at Midway.
Yeah, Dan and Amy. So Dr. Ferreira over there in L.A., she's putting down the gauntlet now. In 2 weeks, they got to get their act together. Otherwise, indoor masking is coming back. She should be more concerned about that 7-Eleven shooter who went around shooting people overnight. Really? That's what she should be more concerned about.
The Ferrara is their public health director in L.A., right? Yeah, thanks for the call, Eduardo. Yeah, I mean, again, as that sad little man said this week, you know, I know you want the pandemic to be over, but it's not. You know why?
Pandemic's not over with you.
Well, you know why? Because I said so. And so did Gavin Newsom, and so did J.B. Pritzker, and so did Phil Murphy, all the COVIDians. Tom, Blue Island.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Professor Epstein referenced Red Auerbach talking about, in one of his books, about the court being flat and the ball being round. And when you have the January 6th committee denying any kind of rights or due process to President Trump, have we not lost that? What is left if you don't have a level playing field? And then, you throw in the Quislings like Jonah Goldberg and David French, and of course the wonderful Tom from Deer Park. Have a nice Friday.
Thanks, Tom. Mitchell in Des Plaines.
Good morning. First of all, I find it really insulting that sloppy Joe Biden continues to use the Putin price hike when it comes to our gas prices. Then you have these vapid-minded radical Democrats who don't understand the law of supply and demand. And they think the reason why oil companies are making all this money is because they're just, price hiking. No, they realize that basically they restricted supply, which increases demand, and doesn't understand that what I call law of supply and demand whatsoever. But the net effect is it's his policy. It's his sloppy Joe's policies that created this mess. This is why they shut down all what I call domestic oil. And the Keystone Pipeline was a function, a delivery system to making sure that we had our own oil. But radical Democrats want to shut that down, and they don't see the big picture.
All right.
He should be fired.
Thanks for the call, Mitchell. I was like, I mean, it's a fair point, but I was like when people say, what I call the law of supply and demand. Oh, you
started that? You're the one to blame for that?
What I call the sun.
Yeah.
Oh, that's your terminology. Wonder where that originated. Brandon in Libertyville.
Hi, Dan. I'm a police officer in a suburb of Chicago, and I just want to talk about the massive recruitment problem that's going on with police right now.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a cop now 12 years, and when I first started trying to become a cop, you'd show up to a police test and there'd be 500 applicants vying for a position, one or two positions. in the last 10 years of the anti-cop narrative, it's not just Chicago. It's the entire suburbs of Chicago. It's nationwide. The suburb that I work at, we had nine people show up at our recent police test. That's it, nine, compared to 12 years ago when, you know, you'd have 500 vying for,
Let me ask you a question about that.
One or two vacancies.
Yeah, let me ask you a question about that. How much recently, I mean, I know it's hard to isolate one thing, but how much of an added disincentive to become an officer is the Safety Act that was passed in the state?
Oh, I mean, it's huge. I think it's all encompassing. I think it's a combination of the Safety Act, the massive anti-cop narrative with the media, and then frankly, how can the public safety sector compete against corporate jobs where, you know, you get to work from home, you get to make your own hours and stuff like that. You know, you get 10 weeks paid paternity leave as opposed to, you know, a government position where you're only getting, you know, 2 weeks sick time or something like that for paternity leave. It's insane, the pendulum swing. And you know, my department is not the only one. If you go on, an interesting website to go on is theblueline.com. It's a police recruitment website for basically all the Chicago suburbs. I've never seen the amount of lateral transfer positions open on that website like never before. Cop departments are just stealing cops from other departments right now and trying in hopes to solve the recruitment problem. That is insane right now. Mm. Every single department Chicagoland wide is short staffed, and they cannot find cops to replace retiring cops, which that's another issue. Is you have cops,
you know, 10
years ago, you had cops. Yeah, you had cops 10 that would be willing to stay on the force 30 years and get their full pension. And now you got cops that are going, screw this, you know, I'm out of here. And, you know, at my 23 year mark. So you just have this rash of retirements. And then that coupled with the fact, and it's not just Chicago, you know, I know that, you know, you see a lot of recruitment issues with Chicago, but it's the suburbs too. I tell you what, all the suburbs cannot find enough personnel to recruit, and they're going, you know, the suburbs are going through police lists like crazy, and they're testing multiple times a year trying to get applicants, and that's basically unheard of until now.
Well,
like I said, I've been the cop now.
Elk Grove is offering a $10,000 signing.
Yeah,
bonus of recruitment.
And I mean, I get sweet in the pot, but also too, I mean, remember that, you know, being police is not a bad job if you're, I mean, especially if you're inclined to be in law enforcement, and then you have your local community backing your play to enforce the law. But I mean, you know, I hear what you're saying about some corporate jobs, Brandon, but then of course the flip side is you don't have defined benefit pensions in corporate America either. So I mean, and that's the trade-off, which is supposed to be the trade-off, the job security, the pension in exchange for maybe a little bit lower salary than your private sector counterparts, although I'm not sure that's really true anymore. But anyway, even so, I mean, it's not a terrible job in terms of comp, overall comp, if you look at it over the course of a career. But even despite that, you've got these recruitment issues. And as Amy said, even with the sweeteners that are being offered by suburban communities and communities around the country as they're trying to recruit from Illinois to other states, you still have this problem that you're describing.
Yep, absolutely. It's so rampant despite everything, despite all the pension and stuff like that. So
thanks for the call, Brandon. Appreciate it. Yeah, and that's why, and the Safety Act. So there are things, you know, there are things that can be done at the local level, and then there's things that can be done at the state level, right? Policing is largely a local matter. However, when you make policing more challenging for police at the state and local level, as this administration has done with the Safety Act, and that's not me saying it, that's district attorneys, state's attorneys around the state saying it. Only two state's attorneys supported the Safety Act. You know who they were? Only two.
I don't know.
Of 102 county state's attorneys. Kim Fox, unsurprisingly, and that buffoon that has been hamming it up for the cameras in Lake County, Reinhart. Those two, that's it. That's it.
He's going to ban assault rifles.
Tremon on the north side. Tremon?
Hi.
Hello.
Good Good morning.
Good morning.
How's it going?
Good. So what's up, Tremont?
I'm just feeling really amazing this morning. I want to get on here and talk about my high school, which is Jesse Spalding. Was the first school to open up for kids with disabilities back in 1908 in Chicago, and probably the first school throughout the country. Just wanted to get on here because we wanted to be recognized. It's Disability Pride Month, July the 23rd, which is the same day as our reunion.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Well, over the years,
oh, go ahead.
So many alumni. We lost so many alumni over the years. And we never had a successful reunion since, I think it was back in 1991 was our last successful reunion, which was in the was a picnic. And I just wanted to get on here and just talk about the highs and the lows of the reunion. You know, it's been a tough journey since January, and there's only three of us on the committee. And I just wanted to let everybody know that this is going to be the reunion of the year. Good. We put so much hard work, sweat and tears into this event. We've been working night and day, early morning.
And when is the reunion, Tremont?
Reunion is July the 23rd at the Mayfield Banquet, which is located 6072 South Archer Avenue, Chicago, Illinois.
Okay.
It's going to start at 6:30 until midnight. We're going to have the blue carpet for our alumni. And the whole purpose of this event is for us to get back together. We never really had an all-class reunion. And it's been, we're all coming together because we're able-bodied and disabled.
That's great.
So we're going to pay homage to our alumni who we lost over the years.
All right, the Jesse Spalding School Reunion, July 23rd.
At Mayfield Banquets at 62nd and Archer. And where can people get more information, Tremont?
You can follow me on Twitter, Tremont Wright. Well, I'm sorry. Actually, it's Lords Gibbs, LORDSKIBBZ. That's on Twitter. You can follow me on Facebook. My name is Tremont Wright, TREMONWRIGHT, as well as on Instagram. And the theme of our reunion is going to be a grand affair together at last.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks
so much,
Tremont.
Good job for your hard work.
Yeah, good.
Awesome.
Have fun at the reunion. That's great. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. Have a great week. I was a little disappointed the other day, Dan, when you were referring to abortion as being a sacrament of the secular humanist religion. And there's nothing humanist about these people.
Well, okay, fair point.
Nothing. No, I just wanted to say that. And they are Malthusian. Mm-hmm. That's what they are. And that is, if the administrative state and all these bureaucrats is the greatest threat to our republic that has to be addressed, then Malthusianism, Thomas Malthus and his idea that we don't have enough resources, too many people, essentially, that is the greatest threat to humanity through stuff like ESG and their environmental movement. It's all about basically diminishing humanity. There's nothing humanist about these people. They are anti-human.
Although now, Frank, I feel compelled to offer a slight correction to what you said. You're right about Thomas Malthus, but he's a very misunderstood economist. So he was wrong about food production versus population growth. But he wasn't one of these ZPG ghouls like we're talking about with the pro-abortion left. He actually was pro-life. And so he didn't come from a position of cultural Marxism that you're seeing on display today.
Oh, absolutely, you are correct. I mean, he was in the 1700s. He certainly would not have agreed with these things. It's just that his name has gotten associated with this. To a certain extent, Adam Smith is the same way. I mean, his phrase "invisible hand" was only said once. He wasn't completely laissez-faire free market like the physiocrats in France. More like Jean-Baptiste Say. So you do have to go back and look at these economists more at their full life and the things that they, you know, wrote and believed more than just the, you know, the taglines that we have with them. Yeah. But the people today,
yeah,
they've taken.
I hear what you're saying.
That one concept. Have a great week. Have a great week.
Thanks for the call, Frank. Appreciate it. Kevin, Austin, Texas.
So all these anti-humanists and the people that you very eloquently describe are trying to ruin Illinois are working hard right now to try to get Pritzker reelected. So I don't want people to forget that even though we really don't want to think about the election and all the nastiness, you got to get involved and help get Bailey and a lot of the other the Republican slate elected. That's the card. That's the hand that we have right now. But you got to get involved because they're working hard. And this is the best opportunity. If you, what is what's if you could describe what the number is, you have to, flip. Is it 10% in Cook County? You can get Bailey in there, at least start the process of dismantling the Democratic machine.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. And I didn't get time to give my review, but you should check out The Offer. You're looking for something to watch. 10-episode limited series, The Offer, the making of the Godfather movie. It is outstanding.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.